Inside Florida Politics. The Essential Podcast powered by Gatehouse Florida. I'm Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett, coming in hot from West Palm Beach, Florida. And I'm joined from Florida's West Coast by Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor Zach Anderson.
Hey, George.
And normally we're joined also by Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief John Kennedy in Tallahassee. But John had the good sense to get out of town for Easter weekend. So it's just Zach and me. But we pledge to not only meet but exceed all standards for podcasting quality. You know, the 2020 presidential race is already well underway with President Donald Trump and more than 15 Democrats already raising tens of millions of dollars. We are going to take a look on the podcast at Florida, which is always a leading ATM for presidential candidates, and see who's leading the early money race in the Sunshine State and what it means for 2020. Also on the podcast, hurricane season is only about 6 weeks away, and Florida could soon have a more hurricane-resilient energy grid. Zach is going to tell us about a bill moving through the legislature with bipartisan support that could bring those improvements, and it could also bring larger electric bills to consumers. And as hurricane season approaches, that means another Trump season in Palm Beach is winding down. As we record this podcast, the president is heading to Mar-a-Lago for Easter weekend, and it could be his final visit of the 2018-2019 season. We will talk about some surprising similarities between President Trump and another part-time Palm Beach president, John F. Kennedy. But first, I think I hear some kind of funky royalty-free music plan. And listeners of the podcast know whenever you hear that drum roll and music, it means it's time for our Pick a Number segment. That is the portion of the podcast where we each put forward a number, and then later on we tell you what that number means in Florida politics. Zach Anderson, do you have a number for us this week?
I sure do, George. My number this week is 45.
45 for Zach Anderson over in Sarasota. And my number is going to be 3,500. So only two numbers to remember this week. You want to hang on to those numbers. 45 for Zach Anderson, 3,500 for George Bennett. Hang on to the end of the podcast and we will explain what those numbers mean in Florida politics. But let's get straight to our loaded lineup. There's been a lot of anticipation this week over the release of some big reports coming out of Washington, D.C. There is that Mueller report, I guess, but also the first quarter Federal Election Commission finance reports for presidential candidates. I know those were due at midnight Monday night. Zach Anderson, I'm sure you were up late Monday hitting the refresh button on the FEC website, right?
Oh, yeah. Waiting with bated breath.
You bet. Well, so the reports are out, and interesting look at some Florida numbers on those. You know, Florida, in 2016, I think Florida was the number four ranking state for contributing to presidential campaigns in both parties. I think California, Texas, and New York were the only states that gave more money. So Florida is always a big money state. Candidates come here to raise money all the time. And so far, President Donald Trump, between his main campaign committee and some of the joint committees affiliated with his campaign, has already raised about more than $5 million from Florida. The 15 or 16 Democrats running for president so far have raised about $1.1 million from Florida. So what's interesting about that Democratic number, and again, you know, it's early, but there are nine other states in Washington, D.C. that have supplied more Democratic campaign cash than Florida has. Clearly, it looks like a lot of Florida donors are taking a wait and see attitude. One of the biggest factors in that, I guess, is Vice President Joe Biden and whether he gets in the race. So you have people kind of waiting to see what Biden does. And but among the money raised so far, Zach Anderson, any guess? Who do you think has raised the most of anybody in Florida? Or maybe you've read this.
That's a tough one. I'm going to go with maybe Bernie.
Well, yes and no, and but maybe. So here's the other thing the other caveat. So the candidates are required to itemize any contribution that's more than $200. And so the FEC reports only are the totals for the state only count that. But so far among in that category, Kamala Harris, the senator from California, has been the top money raiser in Florida. She has raised $326,000 in the state. And then Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota has raised $127,000. And Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey has raised $102,000 from Florida. Bernie Sanders has raised $94,000-something from Florida of contributions of more than $200. But Bernie, it has probably raised more than that in Florida. We don't know how much more because 84% of Bernie Sanders' contributions nationwide have been $200 or less. And as we mentioned, those small contributions are not itemized and counted in that statewide total. So Bernie's raised $94,000 in Florida and, you know, probably more than that if you figure in the small dollar donations. But clearly, and when you compare it to, Trump, when you compare it to the money Trump has raised in the state, it's kind of an underwhelming number so far for Democrats. Zach Anderson, and here's the thing though. I mean, the Biden factor, it's true in every state that, you know, there, people are waiting to see what Biden does. But Zach, any reason you think that Biden might be more of a factor in a state like Florida?
Definitely. As you mentioned, these numbers are a little bit underwhelming for Democrats, but not really surprising. You know, a lot of people running are senators or people who have bases of support in other states like New York or California. So it makes sense that really a lot of their money is going to be coming from those other states. They might not have a huge base of support in Florida yet. And Florida, you know, it was a big Hillary Clinton state more than Bernie Sanders. It tends to be a little bit more geared towards the establishment Democrats. You have a lot of older voters who are not, you know, maybe super progressive, just kind of old school Democrats who, you know, maybe go more for the establishment candidate. And I think somebody like Biden, who has a lot of connections, who's been around a long time, probably could raise a lot of money in this state. So you might see a lot of donors sort of sitting on the sidelines waiting to see what he does.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, I know I talked to several donors who are, you know, kind of big time establishment wing donors who are waiting to see what Biden does. And I'm sure if he gets in the race, which people expect, but you never know until he actually does it, that a lot of money from those folks is going to flow towards
another Biden fun fact with Florida. Steve Shale, who is well-known to most Florida politicos, is a huge Biden fan. You know, Shale ran President Obama's campaign in Florida in 2008, and he stayed in the mix since then. And I've talked to him kind of casually, and I think that he is weighing whether or not to get involved in the Biden campaign if Biden runs. And so there could be a pretty strong Florida connection for Biden with Shale, who's very well connected throughout the state and could really help bring in some money for Biden as well.
Yeah. And, you know, another factor, I was talking to another donor from down here, a guy named Fred Cunningham, a lawyer, and he's hosted Hillary Clinton in his house and other, you know, big time had other big time Democratic fundraisers. And one of the things he said is in Florida, a lot of donors are still licking their wounds from 2018. Remember, you know, this state had two very big, expensive races statewide in 2018, the Bill Nelson and Andrew Gillum races that Democrats lost both of those. So, you know, couple reasons why the on the Democratic side, the money has definitely not been flowing yet. Another thing, I talked to John Morgan, the who is a mega donor and you know, behind the medical marijuana amendment, and he's backing the minimum wage amendment that's coming up next year. And Morgan is a guy, he's hosted fundraisers for Obama and Hillary Clinton in his home. But he said, you know, especially early in the process, a lot of these Democrats want to focus on the small dollar donors. And he said a lot of these candidates thinks he used the word that is toxic to take big donor money now. And I asked, you know, Morgan how he feels about that, because he's kind of the epitome of the big donor or big bundler, you know, organizing a fundraiser or a bunch of people coming. And he said going to bundlers' homes is not a good optic. And his reaction to that, he said, was praise God, because at least that means he's going to hang on to his money a little bit longer. But you know, I have no doubt that at the end of the day, a ton of money is going to flow to whoever the Democratic nominee is in Florida. As it's already been flowing, though, on the Republican side, as I mentioned, you know, more than 5 million from Florida has already gone to President Trump. And then the last factor that's, you know, as far as why the Democratic contributions have not been real impressive so far in Florida is that there aren't really candidates that have much of a tie to the state or have spent much time here. Although one candidate who was in the state recently is Klobuchar, the Minnesota senator. Zach, what was she up to recently here in Florida?
Well, Klobuchar has been to the state twice. She was in Tampa earlier, and then she was up in Tallahassee recently, and she met with Democratic leaders in the state House of Representatives, trying to cultivate some ties there for people who maybe would help with her campaign. But then she also sort of talked to reporters, just trying to get a little bit of exposure and maybe some media coverage. And, you know, people asked her about various issues. She's made climate change a big part of her campaign. You know, she's also talking a lot about healthcare. And she said that she was trying to just learn a little bit about Florida issues, because there are quite a number of Florida specific issues, things like Venezuela. You know, obviously there's a lot of issues with, you know, relations with Cuba and other things like that. So it seems like she's just trying to get a little bit of a toehold here and make some connections.
And although John Kennedy is not with us on the podcast, he did leave behind a little bit of audio. This is one clip that Thomas Cordy here is going to cue up of Klobuchar talking to reporters in Tallahassee just about her ability to take on Donald Trump in the general election.
I have been able to win Trump voters. I won 40 of the counties that he won. And that is simply that I find common ground with people. I'm willing to talk about things like storm sewer issues and agriculture and what it means if you're trying to make food to get it on someone's table and people don't appreciate it. I have an understanding of that not everyone wants a four-year degree. My own sister didn't get a four-year degree. She didn't graduate from high school at first. My dad got a two-year degree, and that we need to be reaching out to people because I think we learned that in 2018 in terms of our platform, but it got lost in Donald Trump running us down every rabbit hole in 2016. And I believe the way you deal with him is stand your ground on your values, which I do all the time. But it's also sometimes you ignore when he sends out a tweet storm just because he wants the news to be on that day. And sometimes you use humor, like I did when he called me Snow Woman and I said, I'd like to see how your hair would fare in a blizzard.
So she is, Amy Klobuchar, ready to take on Donald Trump's hair. And I think, did she mention storm sewer issues? Did I hear that? Is that? I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how that.
One of the biggest issues in any presidential campaign, where you're at on storm sewers.
But, yeah, you know, a reasonable point she's making that obviously there were a lot of voters that Democrats did not appeal to, that Hillary Clinton did not appeal to in 2016, that she's saying that she has the ability to win over. What did you think of that, though? What did you think of that
little bit of Klobuchar there, Zach.
Well, I think a lot of Democratic strategists agree with her. It's a big question of whether the Democratic base agrees with her. You know, this idea of finding common ground, it sounds good. It sounds logical. But I think a lot of Democrats would like to just see the ground burned beneath Donald Trump and him collapse and disappear forever. I think that, you know, there's obviously an appetite, a real distaste for the president amongst the liberal base. And we saw in Florida where the most liberal candidate got nominated for the governor's race. He didn't win, which might give some people some second thoughts about going in that direction. But Klobuchar, she's kind of known as more of a centrist, at least in this field. She hasn't advocated for single payer. She's not talking about abolishing ICE. She's not talking about free college for everyone. She's talking more about sort of Midwestern pragmatism, trying
storm
to reach
sewer
out.
Issues.
Yeah, storm sewer issues. And that could be a good strategy in a general election to sort of take some of the drama out of the race and just say, I'm the no drama candidate. You know, if you want somebody who's constantly tweeting and ginning up drama, vote for the president. But I'm just going to put my nose down and get things done. Whether it can win in a primary, we'll see. But I do think there is an appetite among voters, even primary voters, for somebody they just think can win. And if Klobuchar is able to make the argument that I have a better chance of winning, I'm more electable, then maybe that does get her through some of this.
We will see what happens. And as it, you know, first of many candidates who are going to be coming through Florida. Well, let's switch gears here. And although Zach is in Sarasota, he is going to talk about a Tallahassee-related issues, so I think that means we should cue up Swamp Rock, the royalty-free Tallahassee theme music there. Zach Anderson, you have been reporting on a bill dealing with utilities and making the energy grid more hurricane resilient. Give us a little summary of that, please.
Yeah, George, it's an issue that's near and dear to my heart and pretty much every Floridian. You know, we all lived through Hurricane Irma in 2017. Two-thirds of the state were without power. Here in Sarasota, the last people didn't get their power on for 2 weeks. I still remember it very vividly. I was without power for a week and remember having all of our food and coolers and changing my daughter's a diaper by flashlight. So those outages are hugely disruptive, but it's a question of how much do you spend to try and limit them in the future. There's been a lot of talk about, you know, how to make the electric grid stronger and how do we prepare for the future so that we don't have as long of electric outages going forward in the next hurricane. But the criticism against some of this new legislation that's moving rapidly, and this gets a little bit wonky, but it creates a new cost recovery clause for storm hardening. Basically, it allows the utilities to pay for things like burying power lines and hardening the grid through a separate system than they currently use. Currently, those activities are covered under the utilities base rates, which are adjusted every 3 to 4 years. But this new bill that's going forward with bipartisan support would allow for rate hikes every year for storm hardening. And they'd also be able to make a profit each year on these activities. And so I spoke with the state's public counsel, who sort of acts as the official consumer advocate for utility customers. And he said there's pretty much no way this won't lead to higher electric bills. The AARP, which advocates for seniors, also is against this because of it could hurt seniors on fixed incomes. But lawmakers are really pushing this. They say that, you know, this is a good way to pay for needed improvements to harden the grid, that we haven't been able to pay for enough of this stuff. And so this would create a way to do that, and that basically the benefits outweigh the costs. When you have all these massive outages, it really hurts the economy and average workers. Also take a hit because businesses are closed for an extended period of time. So, you know, if you can limit these electric outages to a couple of days versus a couple of weeks, you could save hundreds of millions or even billions in economic activity for people. A little side note on this, utilities really seem to love this bill. I got a comment from FPL and they said that they were very strongly in support of this. They actually came up with the idea for the bill. I talked to the sponsor, Senator Joe Gruters, and he said the utilities came to him with this idea and he liked it.
Have we mentioned Joe Gruters on the podcast before?
It wouldn't be an Inside Florida Politics if we didn't mention Joe Gruters. But one of the reasons for that is he's pretty much everywhere. He's filed 69 bills, which is the most in the Senate. And he's also chair of the Republican Party of Florida. So he's in the mix on pretty much everything. And with these utilities, they came to him and he said that he liked the idea and he thought it was worthwhile. But it's worth noting that utilities have a ton of influence in Tallahassee. I mean, they might be the most powerful special interest in the entire state. The four big investor-owned utilities gave more than $3 million to the Florida GOP over the last 4 years. They also gave hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Democratic Party of Florida. And that might explain why no Republican or Democrat has voted against this bill, even though it seems certain to bring considerable rate hikes down the line.
So obviously hardening utilities, putting utilities underground and stuff like that is going to cost money. And
right.
But it sounds like what you're saying is the formula for passing that money along. There's some, or at least some consumer advocates are questioning the method for doing that and you know, how it's passed along.
Yeah, they basically say that what they're doing by creating a separate cost recovery clause is almost like a blank check, that through this system, there's not as much scrutiny as if you keep these storm hardening activities in the base rate. And with the base rate, it's sort of you take everything that the utilities do, all of their expenses and all of their revenues, and you sort of weigh them against each other. And so if they're doing a lot of storm hardening, maybe that gets canceled out because they have a lot of growth in their revenues. And so it doesn't lead to rate hikes. But under this cost recovery clause, you only look at this individual issue, the storm hardening, and they're sort of automatically guaranteed to get their money back plus a profit. So there's a big incentive to do a lot of this storm hardening if you know that you're going to get reimbursed for it and get a profit. And there's concern that they might maybe go a little bit overboard with this and that the balance might get kind of out of whack because everybody wants this storm hardening. It's very important for the state that our electric grid is more resilient. It's just a question of how do you do it so that it doesn't hurt the ratepayers too much too quickly.
There you go. Good reporting by Zach Anderson on something that will affect just about every consumer in Florida. Well, last item, we mentioned President Donald Trump, as we record this, is preparing to arrive in Palm Beach for Easter weekend. Since it's late April, this is usually about the end of Trump season in Palm Beach. This will be Trump's 24th visit to Palm Beach. And, the other part-time Palm Beacher who was president, of course, was John F. Kennedy. His family had the Kennedy compound kind of at the north end of Palm Beach, about 5 miles north of where Trump's Mar-a-Lago is. And so I was looking back at via the JFK Library, they have the Kennedy's schedule. His appointment books day by day are available, and you can look through them and see what he was doing on a particular day. And so I was looking at the amount of time Kennedy spent in Palm Beach. So here's what's interesting. And Trump gets a lot of grief for the amount of time he spends down here in Palm Beach. At the end of this weekend, he will have spent at least a portion of 91 days in Palm Beach as president. And that the way most people who keep track of this stuff count it, if the president arrives on a Friday evening and leaves on a Sunday afternoon, he's basically in town for about 48 hours, but it counts as 3 days, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So Trump has spent at least a portion of 91, will have spent a portion of at least 91 days in Palm Beach. At the same stage in his presidency, John F. Kennedy had spent about 96 days in Palm Beach. And Kennedy had made, I think we mentioned Trump has made 24 trips. Kennedy made, 16 or 17 trips to Palm Beach. So he tended to stay here for a longer periods of time when he was here. And the last little parallel I wanted to mention was whenever the president is here, the White House is usually pretty stingy about revealing what he does while he's here. Even, he'll go to the golf course for 5 hours, and a lot of times they won't even actually confirm that he's playing golf, leaving open, I guess, the possibility that he's wearing golf clothes and a baseball cap at his golf club and maybe making phone calls all day. But you know, they usually don't even confirm that he's playing golf or who he plays with. And so there's always a lot of grousing among reporters about the lack of information. Well, I was looking at the Kennedy schedules. At one point in 1962 for Easter, Kennedy was in Palm Beach for 10 days. And his official schedule, the entire time, the only things that are noted is that he went to Good Friday service in Palm Beach, and then Easter Sunday went to private mass at the Kennedy compound. That's it for 10 entire days Kennedy was here in Palm Beach. So the tradition of presidents not revealing a whole lot about what they do when they're in Palm Beach is a long-standing one. Well, I think I hear that funky royalty-free music playing again, which means it's time to return to our pick a number segment. Only two numbers this week. So, Zach Anderson, your number was 45. What does 45 mean?
Yeah, George, 45% is the number of municipalities in Florida that do runoff elections. And I actually got that number from a very good Palm Beach Post story that ran recently about runoff elections. And it raised the question, is it time to finally end runoff elections? Which I thought was interesting. I'd never really thought about it. But, you know, some people think that these are too costly, that, you know, you should just give the seat to whoever gets the most votes. Why have another election right away? You know, it costs a lot of money. You know, it involves a lot of extra campaigning for people. You know, it requires voters to have some stamina and come back to the polls. One of the more interesting things in that article you guys wrote was a comment from a University of Florida professor. And this is something I had no idea. But Professor Michael McDonald noted that runoffs are commonly used throughout the South, and the implication being that they're sort of a relic of the Jim Crow area. And here's a quote from Michael McDonald. It was a mechanism to make sure if there was a single African-American candidate on a ballot and multiple white candidates, the African-American candidate wouldn't somehow sneak in and win the election because white candidates were splitting the white vote. And I just found that fascinating. You know, there's been a lot of talk in Florida about relics of the Jim Crow era with this Amendment 4 and giving ex-felons automatically restoring their voting rights instead of making them go through this really arcane clemency process. And this may be another relic of the Jim Crow era are these runoff elections. I don't think most people think that that's, I don't think, you know, that really crosses the mind of many people now that, you know, potentially this is keeping African-Americans from winning seats. But it is apparently a legacy of this. Despite that, there's not really much of a push to end runoff elections. But here in Sarasota, you know, when I brought this up to some of the local commissioners, one of them raised the idea of what's known as an instant runoff election or ranked choice voting. And this is an issue that's been percolating in the city for a while. It was actually voted on 10 years ago to go to ranked choice voting, but they never did it because they didn't have the hardware to do this kind of voting. It's an interesting form of voting. It's been employed across the country, not really widespread, but some jurisdictions have started to do it. And basically, instead of just choosing one candidate, you rank all the candidates on the ballot. So if you have six candidates running for the city commission, you say, well, here's my first choice, here's my second choice, here's my third choice. And if your first choice doesn't win, then your vote goes to your second choice until one of the candidates gets above 50%. And so you have sort of an instant runoff system. And the city of Sarasota is pushing to try, or some people within the city are pushing to try and adopt that. This Sarasota would be the first jurisdiction in Florida to adopt ranked choice voting if they were able to do it. But they've had problems getting the Secretary of State to certify the software to do it. So we'll see. Maybe they could be the first.
Two notes on that. One, ranked choice voting. Can you imagine in the state that had the butterfly ballot and where, you know, 25,000 people skipped the Senate race in Broward County? Can you imagine ranked choice voting, just how that might be implemented in Florida.
The other thing is you add a lot of math in there, it does seem to present the distinct possibility of complicating things.
I just, you know, in Florida, anything that can go wrong will go wrong. The other thing is that you mentioned the Jim Crow history. That's, yeah, for sure, because in Florida and other southern states, you know, the Democratic Party used to be the only game in town. And so, right, the concern was that if you had, you know, kind of like Florida's Democratic primary for governor last year, I mean, you had one black candidate win with 33% or 34% of the vote. Against a bunch of white candidates. So you know, that's the kind of thing back in the Jim Crow days that a southern state would have, you know, would have wanted to squash out because it, you know, it used to be in the South, winning the Democratic primary was tantamount to winning the general election. So
it's amazing, yeah, the different things that they came up with to prevent black people from having any political power. But I never thought that runoff elections were one of them.
There you go. Wow. So anyway, so my number, we are doing the pick a number segment, but, my number is, 3,500. That is the, as in $3,500, that's the amount of the refund that, Cindy Yang requested and received from the Palm Beach County Republican Party for a contribution she made in February. Yang, of course, is the former massage parlor owner who got that selfie at a Super Bowl party with Donald Trump, and it went viral, and it drew attention to her business, which was basically selling Chinese clients access to events at Mar-a-Lago. And while she was not hasn't been accused of breaking the law or anything, but certainly got a lot of negative publicity, so much so that the chairman of the Palm Beach County Republican Party disinvited her to the recent Lincoln Day dinner at Mar-a-Lago. So anyways, after that, Cindy Yang had given $3,500 to the local party earlier in the year, and she recently asked for a refund, and the party chairman signed the check to her. And I think this is kind of what's telling about money in politics. While he did give her the refund and while he did disinvite her from the Lincoln Day dinner, Michael Barnett, the party chairman, said he hopes that Yang will be able to contribute in the future. He said, "I'd love to have her back at any events in the future as long as we can get this behind us." Well, that wraps up another Inside Florida Politics podcast. I am Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett. Always my honor to host the podcast. I've been joined by Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor Zach Anderson. And next week, we should see the return of our third podcaster from Tallahassee, Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief John Kennedy. I've been assisted here in West Palm Beach by Thomas Cordy. And as always, the man behind the curtain in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, the Gatehouse Digital Audio Production Director, Adam Fish. Thank you.